Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
Welcome into the NBA Morning Deuce for Wednesday, March 24th, and we are about 24 hours by the time you're listening to this from the trade deadline, and things are heating up, and it's probably a good day to have a six-game slate of blowouts until these last games. As we're recording, we still got Warriors-Sixers, which suddenly, as we're recording this podcast, is a game. And we got potential Dame time, which, as the listeners of this show know, it's my favorite part of the NBA season this year. But there's tons of NBA chatter to talk about. There's a lot of injuries to talk about, as you heard me talk about on the solo deuce yesterday. And who better than one of the best in the business to talk about all these things with than co-host of Hardwood Knox on Blue Wire Podcast. I know I messed that up a little bit yesterday, but I got it right today. Writer for Bleacher Report, Dan Favalli. Dan, thanks for jumping on with me.
Oh, no problem. Thank you so much for having me on the night of the Tony Bradley game, apparently. Super exciting.
Tony Bradley. Hey, you saw what Joel Embiid tweeted last week. He said, let's blow it up and build around Tony Bradley. So, hey, maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, Embiid's probably going to get traded on Thursday now. Bradley's just coming for a spot. Do you really need Joel Embiid and Dwight Howard if you have Tony Bradley? I wouldn't think so.
No, of course not. And hey, in a season where it's supposed to be a slow deadline, it looks like everyone else in the league's getting traded. So, hey, we might as well trade Joel Embiid while we're at it, right?
Yeah, I mean, hey, why not?
Yeah. So, look, as I mentioned, Dan, like, there's six games tonight, not a huge slate. The first four games of the night were all terrible. We got two games going on right now. We're going to get to the trade talk, but let's start. I mean, we should start, I guess, because of how much injuries are now impacting the NBA. And I talked about it yesterday. I don't remember in recent memory, and maybe you do, a season where so many elite, and when I say elite, I mean top five, top 10, top 15 players have nagging injuries that we don't really know much about, that are impacting teams that are championship level teams, guys that are in the MVP conversation, which I guess would give us a perfect place to start with this Lakers game tonight. They get blown out by the Pelicans. And it's not even so much that they get blown out by the Pelicans. It's that I've watched a ton of Pelicans this year. They're not just a bad defensive team. They are an atrocious defensive team. And watching this Lakers game without LeBron and AD, of course, they're not going to be very good. But the inability to put up any type, I mean, I know they scored 111, but it wasn't a real 111. This thing could get way worse if AD doesn't get back soon. Like, I'm a little more concerned than I thought I'd be about the Lakers because of how close the West is, not about them potentially like missing the playoffs or anything, but seeding wise, this thing could get pretty bad if these guys are both out. We know LeBron's out for at least a month. We don't know when AD's back.
Yeah. They should make the playoffs. And I say should because, you know, you look 10th place right now is only four losses behind them. That's the Grizzlies. And that's six games overall. They shouldn't drop out of the playoffs entirely, but it'd be wild if we end up with the Lakers and the Mavericks in the play-in tournament. And then you have the Jazz and the Suns sitting at the top of the West. Who would have predicted that at the start of the season? It's definitely concerning And I don't know how to paint a rosy picture of the Lakers without LeBron. You can look at the data. You don't even need to watch. And I would recommend probably not watching at this point, but it's just bad with when he's not on the court. They've been able to scrape by a little bit when you have both Schroeder and Kuzma, but that's such a small sample size. I don't know how it projects over the long term. I might argue though, that this is more unfortunate for a team like the Suns or the Jazz, because if they sit at 1-2 for the rest of the year, which is feasible, and you wind up with the Lakers at 7 or 8 because they fell into the play-in, you just went through this entire season, are at the top of the West, and then you're going to get a Lakers team that has LeBron and AD in the first round. That would really suck for them. It's obviously a bigger deal to the Lakers because you want, look, LeBron, age 36, you know, how long will he be out? What will he look like upon return? And then just with Davis, you know, I'm not a doctor, but just anytime you hear the Achilles mentioned, it's just scary. We saw what happened with KD in the finals in 2019 now? That feels like forever ago. So there's real concerns there, but I don't think the Lakers need to care about if you believe that Anthony Davis and LeBron are both going to be healthy for the playoffs. I really don't think you need to worry that much if you're the Lakers fans. It's just you're probably in for an ugly 4 to 6 weeks of basketball.
I would go even I would even go further on who it could suck for is, now let's just say LeBron's out for the next month and a half, because you know how these injuries are. They say a month and then it becomes a month and a half and maybe longer at his age, but AD comes back. So they're good enough to win games. Let's say they fall to the sixth seed and you're the Clippers. Now you got the Lakers in the first round. You lose in the first round of the Lakers. Your whole future's up in the air because of Kawhi. He's got a player option. He talked a couple weeks. Last week where he said, we're not consistent enough. Anything could happen with that guy. I think with the Suns, you see, I mean, obviously you want to win, but a loss to the Lakers is not like devastating. Jazz kind of have their future somewhat figured out. Although I guess anything could happen with Donovan and Rudy and that, but a team like the Clippers, if they ended up having to play the Lakers in the first round, that could blow up the whole franchise.
I honestly gave that zero thought. And that's a great point. I would expect Kawhi to still resign just because he went to such lengths to go to the Clippers, but there are reports that the chemistry there is better, but something's been off, especially, you know, the Paul George and Kawhi minutes have been fine, but the offense, it's really good, but it's so dependent on shooting. And we know jump shooting teams can win a title, but you still want that guy who's going to be able to put more pressure on the rim and get to the line. They really only, you know, Kawhi gets to the line at a high level, but when you're looking at players who put pressure on the rim, he and Paul George, their games, and even Lou Williams, their games inherently bail out before the rim. Same with Marcus Morris. So they might not have an offense that's built for the playoffs. Their defense has just been weird this year. People talk about them needing a point guard. They assume it's for the playmaking, which makes sense because of how poorly they've played in crunch time. They might need someone other than a Patrick Beverley option to go up against point guards. It might just be the defense that's concerning. So that's a fantastic point. And if you're a fan of chaos and you thought free agency was going to be boring, you want to root for the Lakers to meet the Clippers then in the first round and beat them, because maybe that does make, you know, maybe it's not a matter of Kawhi rethinking about staying with the Clippers. Do we get to a point where they're like, well, then maybe we should be moving Paul George for a different type of co-star next to Kawhi?
Yeah, well, because I've also made the point about the Clippers since last year, since we saw what happened with that team, and that we have to sort of rethink about Kawhi, what he is as a star, because when he played for Toronto, he was not the leader. He was the star. When he played for San Antonio, he was not the leader. He was he was the best player, but he wasn't the leader. It was Kyle Lowry. They had other championship level players, Serge, Marc Gasol, et cetera. San Antonio is obviously the same thing. Goes to the Clippers. Now he has to be a leader. And I don't think that's what he does. And yes, I agree. Either you have to maybe move Paul George to get another leader type in there next to him, or maybe he sees the writing on the wall and he's like, I don't want that. Like, I don't want to be the emotional leader of a team because I don't have emotion. Let me go somewhere that has an emotional leader. And then, if they have to play the Lakers, that being said, this was about how, if they have to play the Lakers in the first round, which obviously, like I said, do you remember a time, like we're watching these games tonight, right? No LeBron and AD. Though if they're healthy, there's really no team in the league that's beaten these guys in a 7-game series, at least in my estimation, right? That's the championship favorites. Then you got no KD. And look, we could all kid ourselves into thinking that the Nets are a competitive team in the East without KD or a championship team. I just don't think they are. I don't know about you. they're playing really good basketball, but I think a lot of it is with the caveat that, hey, Kevin Durant's going to come back eventually. That makes them a championship team. Giannis has a knee sprain. Don't know. It doesn't seem, I don't think it's that bad, but still Giannis has a knee sprain. Didn't play last night. Joel Embiid is not playing. MVP candidate, best team in the East. I just don't remember a time where all these guys on top level championship level teams are out with these nagging type injuries too.
Yeah, I've been covering the league full time for like a decade now, maybe a little bit less, and I don't remember it ever being this. I feel like I also say that every year, but just when you look at the MVP race specifically, the fact that it can turn so heavily just on injuries, because one, the scope of the MVP race is so huge. I don't remember it being this big where, depending on the day, you could probably talk me into one of six different players actually winning. You want to make a case for Dame? Not my first place pick. I'll listen to you. You want to make a case for Harden? I will more than listen to you. So yeah, you've mentioned Durant. Embiid was my MVP favorite until he got injured. LeBron had to be up there. He definitely wasn't my pick. Now he's injured.
He's the Vegas pick, right? He's been the Vegas odds on for a while now. So it's like, you know, there's that.
And I think Giannis practiced Tuesday, but I think I saw that. I hope I'm not lying on my first appearance on this podcast, but
it's all good.
Still, you hear knee sprain, it's like, well, are they going to play it? Because they're guaranteed a top three seed in the East at this point. Is it really that important for them to get to, you know, number one? They are within a game and a half of Philly. So do they slow play it with him a little bit? The Nets are probably, Lakers we already talked about. They might be the most interesting when you're looking at the injuries. Philly, yeah, you want Embiid back. It's a bone bruise. It's not like not one of his chronic issues that he's had. So you feel pretty good. The Nets are interesting just because, you know, Kyrie's going to miss games here and there. His, you know, MO throughout his career, nothing really chronic, I think, since he's left college, at least some knee issues. But Durant is just coming off the Achilles injury, and now he has the hamstring problems. You have to be a little bit worried. And it vindicates their decision to trade for James Harden, in my opinion. But the whole idea was, the James Harden playoff stuff, it has at times been overblown, but it's absolutely fair to question his effectiveness in the playoffs relative to his regular season performances. He just hasn't been the same. The idea was to have him with Kyrie and KD so that if he does struggle, it doesn't matter. Or two, you just can't cover him enough for it to really matter. If you have to go into this, I think they could still come out of the East if they have just James Harden and Kyrie. I wouldn't pick them to come out of the East. I might not even pick them to come out of the East right now. If you could tell me Joel Embiid's healthy in Philly and that Milwaukee's fully healthy. So they're the team that I really look at, because it feels like if they have KD, there's a chance that this is all just, we're having this conversation for naught. They have that potential, I think, more so than any other team right now. But without KD, I don't know what, you know, could you see them coming out of the East? Could you also see them losing to, you know, who would they play if they end up being, let's say, three? You know, I guess the Knicks. So yeah, they won't lose in the first round, but do they make it out of the second round? I honestly don't know.
I do think, now I'm not in their heads and I don't know these. I worked in the league for a while, but I never worked with any of the particulars, specifically Kyrie and Harden. I was with the Hornets and the Grizzlies. So I obviously didn't work with any of those guys, but I think they even have a level of confidence that they're playing with right now, freedom that it's like, we're not fully healthy. We don't have KD. They're just out there free flowing. You know, booty holes get tight when Kevin Durant's not out there in the playoffs. You know what I'm saying? Like if it comes down to that, I think we're going to see a different Nets team than what we're seeing right now in the regular season. And like the Harden MVP thing, it's fair. And I think there is an argument that people are making that he could be MVP. But I also think a lot of those people are making that argument in the back of their head, saying this team will have Kevin Durant eventually. If Kevin Durant wasn't on this team and he was putting up these numbers, I think a lot of the same people would be like, well, what's he doing different than what he did in Houston, putting up good numbers on a team that won't win in the playoffs?
Right. And it's funny that his MVP case is also sort of rooted in the fact that they haven't had Kevin Durant for so long, whereas he might like, I think it hurts him if Kevin Durant gets healthy in that scope. But I would argue that he needs him for the playoffs. It's just a very weird balance there, but I'm in 100% agreement with you. I do think, you know, if you're a Nets fan or if you're the Nets, I do think this has at least vindicated your decision to move, because you've shown how sketchy the availability of your stars is going to be.
And it makes all the other teams in the league that were afraid of trading for James Harden look dumb. And we'll talk about at least one of those teams tonight. We have to,
Although, at least, I guess and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the guess I didn't think is like, you probably didn't want James Harden having to go this hard during the regular season, because that's what he's had to do for the past however many years in Houston. And, you know, you probably thought like, oh, Kevin Durant is not going to play back-to-backs. And now it's, oh, Kevin Durant hasn't played in what, six, 7 weeks? How long has it been now?
It's, I don't even know. It's been a while. It's, he's only, he hasn't even, I don't think he's played in over 50% of their games, right? I mean, it's been, he's been,
now, he was, for, he was an MVP candidate before he, 100%. I think it was COVID and then he got the hamstring injury. So that's, this MVP race has just been the it's changed daily.
Basically. Yeah. And I think it even, absolutely bonkers. It could have even changed tonight, because we'll talk about the Nuggets game, but I mean, Jokic had another monster game. So, I mean, he's obviously in the mix every game he plays. Before we move on from the Lakers game, we got to at least mention the Pelicans. They get it's a nice win. Obviously, anytime you're playing a team without LeBron and AD, it's not a huge win, but notable from this game, Zion goes for 27. He becomes, I think he has the most consecutive 20-point games for a player at his age. And he passed. I saw the tweet. I don't remember exactly who it was, but he has like 21 straight games with 20 points. He's the youngest player to do that ever. It just continues to have an absurd season. They're not great. I'm not buying in on this team yet, but he's putting up numbers. So people are happy with it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he's good. And I'm happy that they've at least put the ball in his hands more, because I feel like he's known as this, you know, as a scout, you're going to speak this better than I am, but just like this power finisher. And he's definitely that, but there's like finesse and there's misdirection to his game. And they've had him handling the ball more in the half court. And he's shown that he can, you know, this isn't just a north south thing. He's doing stuff east and west. He's spinning and he's beating guys, not just when he has a head start, but like he's beating them from standstills. I think he's shown, you know, traces of a post up game. So he's really good. I can't figure out the Pelicans really. I just don't get them. And it's like Lonzo Ball, you know, prior to missing these past couple games, he's been playing really well since entering the trade rumor mill. But then I look at him, he's so complimentary and so good, but I don't know how much he moves the needle for this team, because it also feels like they need like someone to replace Drew Holiday, or at least a point guard who can do something more, I hate to use the word conventional, but like run pick and rolls in the half court and be a threat to score when he's like driving or want to drive at all. And he doesn't seem like that player. And that's the argument to move him, because he's about to be a free agency and you've paid Brandon Ingram. You paid Steven Adams for some reason. Good player. I just don't like his fit on this roster. And I don't actually think Steven Adams has necessarily been their problem. And now you're going to pay, you have Eric Bledsoe for another year. And now you're going to pay Lonzo, what, like 18, 20 million a year. The team is fascinating. I don't buy into them in the short term, but with the way that Zion has played on offense, and again, the growth that you've seen from Lonzo on offense, and then knowing that Brandon Ingram, at least like last year, that clearly wasn't a fluke. You can quibble about what he's done defensively for them, which is to say not that much. They have a lot of talent, but they're not good. And yet they're about to be expensive. It really confuses me.
Yeah. I have a feeling that I wouldn't be shocked. And this is the first time I'm saying this, but as I've watched them and I see what they've done this year, I don't think Stan Van Gundy is going to be there very long. It seems like coaching. Their defense is so bad. I mean, it's really like, as much as, you know, the points about Lonzo are interesting, but to me, when I watch this team, their defense is atrocious. And Steven Adams is okay, but he's been bad in pick and roll. And I don't know. They've been scoring the ball pretty well. I would pay Lonzo. I talked about this with Jabari on Monday when he was on the show, and I really like what Lonzo has developed into. And I also think if you move him, you better get somebody as good or close to Drew Holiday, because defensively he is your point of attack. You know, he's your best perimeter defender right now in a lineup full of guys who really don't defend. Zion, we'll see what happens as he develops, but Brandon Ingram doesn't defend. And whether it's Eric Bledsoe, who's fine, Nikhil Alexander-Walker, who's fine, you know, they got to figure things out defensively. And I'm confused about them too. And, you know, there was high expectations for this team, even this year, to be at least a playoff, pushing for the playoffs. If they go in now, there's still time. Maybe they make a late push. Maybe they get into play and maybe they even get eight, seven seed. But, you know, Stan's going to have to figure out things defensively, which has always been his calling card. So if he can't coach them up defensively, I don't know how long the experiment lasts. I love, he's a good dude, but that's my thing right now. It's just like, they seem to have the pieces to be a functional team, but they're not defensively. And I will also say this, in the NBA, when two players in your starting lineup are literally negative shooters, not even non-shooters, just negative shooters, everyone else on the floor has to be knockdown shooters. And Brandon Ingram's a great one-on-one scorer, but he's not known as a knockdown three-point shooter. Bledsoe's shooting the ball better this year, but starting Lonzo and Bledsoe in the backcourt together, that's sort of a problem. Lonzo's probably the best shooter in your starting lineup, and as good as he's shooting the ball, that's probably part of a problem too. When you have Steven Adams and Zion out there who basically, I mean, the fact that Zion's scoring the ball the way he is with Steven Adams on the floor is a testament to what Zion is actually doing offensively this year.
Yeah, and I mean, you have a great point with the shooting. That just might be the biggest, you know, that's what Steven Adams is doing wrong, is just the space he's occupying on the floor for that might be their biggest problem. And I don't know what's going on with Eric Bledsoe. I would have felt a lot better about this team if he was defending like he was, you know, like he was last season. Like, I don't know what stuff watching him, and I don't count myself as a super technical guy, but he looks like someone who's lost off the ball, like wandering down an aisle looking for his mom or dad as a toddler. And I don't necessarily get it. And that feels like that's hurt them, because I really like Lonzo's ability to sort of disrupt in a defense, but he doesn't feel like he should be your one-on-one guy to defend the point of attack. Like, I don't know if that's going to be him, and I would pay him because I don't have, you know, I'm not going to be, I don't care about billionaire owners' wallets. The reality of the team with Josh Hart entering free agency too. I thought there at the beginning of the year, when you looked at their defensive shot profile, I thought they were letting up too many threes for that to sustain. I didn't think it was going to implode like it did. Like this. And I thought their biggest problem was going to be, well, could they get enough competent wing minutes? But it feels like they just have, outside of really Zion and of late Lonzo's performance, it just feels like they have all these different issues anywhere. And I think your point is probably the most salient one for me. This isn't even their biggest problem either, because they, even in the half court, they've been better offensively this year. Is just, you know, there should be more spacing around Zion. And if you want to play Bledsoe and Lonzo together for stretches, even just having Ingram, because he is shooting, like he's shooting better from three. I think he sprinkled in more off the dribble looks this year too. But like you said, he's not this knockdown guy. And so they still intrigue me. And I think they have that name recognition, like the actual talent to make a run, but I'm just not sure. The pieces, I guess I'm trying to say, might actually fit together worse than was initially expected, where you like looked at one or two different issues, Adams not spacing the floor being chief among them, and now it's like, well, there's all these trickle down effects, and if they're going to be this bad defensively, you need to be like lights out offensively, top three in the league, which they clearly aren't right now.
Yeah, and I think I bring this up every time we talk about a Pelicans game, but I'm gonna bang this drum until Stan does it. Zion needs to be playing the five, and they just got to surround him with shooters. Switch everything, get out and run. And right now, that might not be the long-term answer, but Zion, you know, defensively, I think he's a five. I know he's 6'6", but he's a freak athlete, and he's probably one of the strongest dudes in the NBA. I don't think he has the lateral movement to guard wings, but I think he can guard most bigs, and he's athletic and long enough to guard most bigs. And you can switch one through five with their size with Lonzo. If he's playing and Bledsoe's pretty long too. And then that sort of answers your problem with having two complete non-shooters on the floor at all time. And with what you're saying about Zion, I was not high on Zion, to be honest. I was not high as everyone else was. I see what everyone sees, but I've always had issues with building your franchise around a guy who literally just can't shoot. He just can't. And but he has impressed me this year. His ball handling is better than I thought it was. And the ability to score around the rim and go down, it's not just downhill, like you said. And because of how athletic he is, it's the way he stays in the air, and his body movement and his body control in the air and scoring around guys and using his body to bounce off of guys and finish at the rim is incredible. I do think, and I think this is probably an easy comparison and people have made it before, it's a little bit, the situation strikes me a little bit like Giannis, where once he plays against great defenses in a 7-game series, they're going to figure out ways to stop him because he can't shoot, but he's still young and that remains to be seen. He has been super impressive with what he's done this year. So, I mean, I can't knock it, but the shot at least there's got to be some semblance if he's going to be your main focus. I think, I don't know, maybe he re-revolutionizes what we're seeing in the NBA. I don't know.
You know. He has to at least be taking them more like Giannis eventually did. And again, there's still time for that to happen. And now people are, you know, Giannis was taking them. That was the first step. Now it's, hey, can you hit your pull-up jumpers at better than a 30% clip or whatever he's at right now? Do you buy into the notion too, which might confuse this team's future even more, that Zion's prime might be more truncated just because of the way that he plays? And so that sort of increases the urgency of the Pelicans to be better. I don't want to say immediately, but very soon, because you're not going to have 12 to 15 years of this Zion. It might be more like, you know, 8 or something like that.
Yeah. And I don't know that it's even, I never really thought about it in the sense of the way he plays. I've always thought about it in his body type. I just don't see how he's just, I mean, he's so huge. He's so big and compact that, and I'm not never, you never hope for it. You knock on wood, but like, it's just, he's, I've always felt like he's like one injury away from not his career being done, but like it really hurting what he does, because everything with him is his explosiveness, and his body type just strikes me as one that is begging for something to happen. It just, and that's where you heard, like when he came in, like, were they going to make him lose weight? Were they going to try to make change the way he walked and his gait and all that stuff? I remember that. Like I always did wonder about that. And like, you saw the thing at Duke where he was so big and athletic, he exploded his shoe, and like, there's always these things. So I have wondered that, like, how long can his prime be and how long can his career be at this size? So yeah, it does concern me a little bit. And the way he plays too, because of his athleticism, it's the same thing I always thought with Russ, which is like, and it's different here because we're not talking about a point guard, we're talking about a big, but like, I always figured with Russ, like once the athleticism starts to go, it's going to be a quick decline. And even though he's not playing terrible, we kind of did see that with Russ over the last couple of years. Like, he's not as athletic as he used to be. He's not quite as good as he used to be. It hasn't happened as quickly, but I could see it happening with Zion for sure. So yeah, there may be that thought process too. But I think more than anything in today's NBA, there's going to be a rush to try to build something competent around him, because if they don't, he's going to leave because it's New Orleans.
That's a whole different conversation. It feels so dirty to have it. You know, I would say when you get these guys, because of the way restricted free agency works, you have to assume he's going to be, you can have him if you want for at least 8 years. That's not really that large of a window when you think about it. I mean, 2 of those years are already done after this season. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there is that reality. It's almost just like, I don't even think about it because I feel like it's just ingrained into the way these teams can. We're seeing it kind of bear out in Minnesota right now, where they're so bad, and it was this way last season, but they still gave up that pick to get D'Angelo Russell, and they're acting, from everything you hear and read, as basically quasi buyers at the deadline, which they have no business being. But that's just the reality that these, and I don't know that it's, and I don't want to be the guy that's like, hey, I'm not trying to look for this next guy who wants out, but it is, it, like you mentioned, it's the reality of the situations there.
Yeah, it's weird. They're going to be a weird team, and it sounds like they're going to buy out JJ. And I still don't understand the Lonzo stuff, but we'll see. Now, mentioned when we were talking about Brooklyn, a team that regrets potentially not pulling the trigger for James Harden, that team, or at least one of those teams, has got to be the Miami Heat, who lost their 4th in a row tonight. It's the Suns, so you can't, how disappointed, no Goran Dragic again. You can't be that disappointed about, you know, you lose to the Suns. They're one of the best teams in the NBA. My bold post all-star prediction, I don't even know if it's that bold, was that they're going to finish with the best record in the NBA. Now you look at all the injuries, if they stay healthy, it seems pretty realistic, but I'm pretty ingrained in Heat Twitter. I host a Heat podcast with Norris Cole, so I see what people are saying. Heat Twitter is losing their minds. They need the trigger to get pulled today. Basically, they've given up on Tyler Hero. They've given up on Duncan Robinson. Kyle Lowry's already a Miami Heat player in their eyes. Their offense has been atrocious this year. And this was a team that, you know, they basically lived and died off the three last year. They're second or third in the league in three-point shooting. Now they're like 28th or 29th. And it's continued. And Tyler Hero and Duncan Robinson have regressed in a big way. They probably need to, it seems like with the deadline coming up, they probably need to pull the trigger here, because this is another situation like I talked about with New Orleans. If you have two guys in your two stars are guys, and this is more so two stars, Jimmy Butler, Bam Adebayo, two stars who don't shoot. Everyone else needs to be shooting the ball well, and no one on this team is shooting the ball well right now.
Yeah, they're so weird. They have, they have the second best defense since February 1st, and so that's fine, but that coincides with the 21st ranked offense. And as you said, the offense's ability to generate space has always been great, but players aren't knocking down shots. It's weird because I don't know what the answer would be for them. Getting Kyle Lowry would be good, but does he fix everything? And you have to look at, okay, he turns 35 in May. Are you giving up Tyler Hero to get Kyle Lowry? And I don't know that I would, just because you've paid Jimmy Butler, you've paid Bam Adebayo, having Tyler Hero's rookie scale, at least that mystery box type of, or lottery ticket, whatever you want to call it, it's kind of valuable, because you're paying those two, and then Lowry's going to get paid this summer. That's what makes it really tough for me. I don't know what the move is for them. I agree with you that they need to do something. And I'm not as ingrained in the Heat Twitter as you, but I do see them like really freaking out.
Yeah.
I did not realize that they were as out on Tyler Hero though.
I think it's a mix. They're definitely out on Duncan. I mean, they seem to be very much out on Duncan. Tyler is polarizing at this point, but I think there's a combination of him. I wouldn't even call it regressing. Maybe it's just like a sophomore wall. We know that the upside's there, but I think they're coming to this realization that, after the finals last year, there was this, oh, this guy's a star. This guy could be a top whatever player in the league. This guy's the future of this team. Now they're thinking like, oh, damn, we didn't give up Tyler Hero for James Harden. It's like a regret type of thing where it's like, and that might have not even have been the case. That's just like reports. Like, do they want to give up Tyler Hero for James Harden, whatever? So I think people they're getting restless, because unlike last year where this team was pretty good throughout the year, and then they made the trade deadline deal, and then they made that run. This year has been lose 5 in a row, win 6 in a row, lose 3 in a row, win 4 in a row. Like, there's no real consistency for the team. And the glaring thing has been the 3-point shooting, among other things. Look, they're towards the bottom of the league in points in the paint too. So there's some glaring things offensively for this team. And everyone knows they're like, it's Jimmy and Bam's team. The pieces have to fit around them, and they don't fit right now. So what do we do? And there's a lot of people who say the same thing about Kyle Lowry, which is, yeah, he's 34, 35 years old. Do you want to pay him for 2 years? Is he the right move? I don't know. Would I give up Tyler Hero for him? I'm on the fence about that too, but he is a 40% 3-point shooter. He can score at all three levels, which the Heat really just don't have right now. And he's a good defender, which, it just fits it fits what their identity is. I would imagine Norm Powell would probably be in the deal as well, because the Raptors got to get rid of Norm Powell. Like, they have to move him, because he's going to get paid. He's going to get paid this offseason, and they just paid three guys who can't get them anywhere anyway. So they can't pay another fringe player, overpay a fringe player to stay in Toronto, I don't think. So Norm Powell's having a good shooting year. It bolsters your team. I don't know that it's the answer to get you over the hump in the East, because the East is just so good this year.
Yeah. And then if you're the Heat, you're in a position to have to pay both Powell and Lowry this offseason. That would get difficult. I agree with you, because look, they've already paid Fred VanVleet. And so you have to imagine at least one of Lowry and Powell gone after this year, because how much money can you invest in that many sub 6'4 players? Just, I think Norman Powell is 6'3. So if you don't trade, or if the reports are that you're not going to give up Tyler Hero for James Harden, then you go and give him up for Kyle. I don't know what the optics look like there.
It's a great point.
I also don't even know, do you have the firepower to even get both Lowry and Powell? Because they can make the money work for sure. But if you're Toronto, given how Hero is played, is the allure of Hero enough to give up both those guys for Hero and salary filler, is basically what it amounts to?
Well, funny enough is from some of the local outlets down here, there's people that have been reporting that Toronto really likes Precious Achiuwa, who people down here are kind of out on too. So, how it is with team Twitter though. It's like, people there, they go up and down so quickly, but the report was that their initial offer was Kendrick Nunn, Precious, and Avery Bradley for Kyle Lowry, not having to give up Duncan or Tyler Hero. which is probably like the opening salvo to see what they could get away with. And the other thing, the stuff I've seen is that it's up to Kyle Lowry at this point. Like that if Kyle Lowry wants to leave Toronto and not re-sign with them, that the Heat have the deal ready and they're willing to pay him 2 years, $50 million. So, I mean, we'll see. It makes them competitive enough to get out. I do think it makes them competitive enough to get out of the East. I think he's an upgrade. But a lot of teams upgraded in the East, so it's weird. And I just don't know what – if they're going to make a move, maybe they don't. If they're going to make a move, I don't know that there's a better option because do you want to trade for Victor Oladipo when he's just going to be in free agency and you could potentially get him in the offseason anyway? And he's been
– if the cost is Kendrick Nunn, I'd put in salary filler, I'd probably do it. I don't know where – I feel like I've always been lower on Kendrick Nunn than the consensus too, but – If I'm the Heat, I'd rather give up none in an Oladipo trade and take that flyer because, look, he did play well for like 8 games in Indy this year or whatever. And you at least know that you should be able to get some good defense from him. And the Heat are not a team that are going to stand him hijacking possessions like he did in the bubble last year or as he's kind of done in Houston at times. And I love Kyle Lowry. I just think he makes so much more sense for a team like the Sixers because I feel like closer than Miami. I know what Lowry would do for Miami with Bam and Jimmy Butler, but it would still feel like there's an element missing. And I don't know if I'm just a loser that's harping on them losing Jay Crowder over the offseason. I didn't understand that. And I know the reports were that they didn't want to give him a multi-year deal. You could have given Jay Crowder the full mid-level over 4, and I think he got it over 3. And that deal still would have been movable if you needed cap space. And I'm very much in the camp of don't count your cap space until you need it. Like you can figure out ways to create cap space. And the Heat of all teams know this. They did it last year. They just got off of James Johnson and Deion Waiters. Those consider like 2 of the more unsavory deals in the league. So I think that they're sort of missing that as well, that element in the front court, like that dynamic 4. And so that if you get Kyle Lowry, it still doesn't address that. You're definitely closer, but I feel like it makes more sense to put Tyler Hero in a trade if you view this as the missing piece that puts you back in the position you were last season. And because the next Nets exist, it might almost be counterintuitive to do that, where I know a lot of people are thinking, well, that's what emboldened you to go after a player to make you as relevant as possible in the East. But if you know a full strength Nets squad awaits, it's almost like, do we even have a 5% chance of winning the title with Kyle Lowry? And I would say that you need the idea of Kyle Lowry, at least, or the idea of a player like Victor Oladipo plus a more dynamic 4. Maybe Trevor Ariza gives them that. I totally space that they acquired him, but he's definitely on offense, not as dynamic as, you know, I know Jay Crowder could be a little overly adventurous at times, I think would be the best way to say it, but Trevor Ariza is not going to give you the same thing. He also hasn't played in like a year at this point.
Over a year because he...
What is time at this point?
Yeah, well, I mean, like he hasn't played since before the league got shut down because he opted out of the bubble. So until now, he's been out. So yeah, I agree. And yeah, I don't think he's the answer. He is I think he, at this point in their careers, I do think he's an upgrade over Iguodala, who's been the backup 4 right now. And you're totally right. The glaring problem there, it's weird because Kelly Olynyk has played actually good for them. He just
doesn't that mess with your like backup 5 rotation.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, that's exactly the point. Those 4 games that Bam just sat a couple games ago, Kelly Olynyk played his best basketball of the season and he was starting at the 5. He's much more suited to be your backup 5. They need a stretch 4, but that then begs the question, like who's the stretch? Who are you going to get? They're saying that the Heat are the favorite to get LaMarcus Aldridge if he hits the buyout market. I don't think that's the answer because he's very good, but he's also older. How many minutes a game are you going to play him?
Better as a 5 too.
Yeah. Exactly. At this point in his career, for sure. Like, do you want to go try to get Aaron Gordon? I don't think so, but like, I mean, he would be a nice piece. And I mean, maybe the Heat can sort of rejuvenate the little bit of disappointment that he's been, but I don't know. For that team, it is a weird situation for them. I just, I get my timeline just gets flooded by Heat, like all this Heat stuff. And I'm just like, they're going to be, that is a fan base that if nothing happens on Thursday, by Thursday, whew, it's going to be give up on the season. We're done. I know that happens with a lot of fan bases, but it's going to be that way for this team.
They and haven't really been like at full strength that much this year. And so you could envision them, even if they do nothing, you know, things breaking right. I wouldn't pick them to come out of the East or even make it to the conference finals. But the best version of this team, I still think, is a lot better than what we've seen.
And no one on the planet would have picked them last year to do it. So it's like, you know, like what it,
I also think that they are a better, in theory, Aaron Gordon destination than people talk about. I think I'm just a little bit more of a believer in Aaron Gordon. If you put him, you know, he probably still has to play the three at times or like a three in Miami, but he really doesn't. And if you give him space to operate, he's shown that he has some real ball skills, even if you don't want to use him like that. I imagine his 3-point clip that he's shooting this year would hold on a team like Miami. Yeah. I mean, it gives you a lot of options defensively, and you can go smaller at the five during no Bam minutes. I don't know. I'm sure Heat fans might hate that he's owed money next year, but like they already kind of punted on cap space a little bit by extending Bam. I could understand it if you were, you know, they might be a good Harrison Barnes destination, but maybe you want to keep the powder dry for 2022. Even at that point, if you can get Harrison Barnes, I'd be like, you can move him in the final year of his deal if you want 2022 cap space. Those are the types of players that I actually think could potentially make a bigger difference for them than Kyle Lowry, if only because we have the, I would imagine you don't give up Hero in one of those deals, but even more than that, you still have the idea of what if Goran Dragic is healthy, you know, not as good as Lowry, but still gives you a, like another self-generating score.
Yeah. I mean, he's been one of the catalysts for this offense. The offense, it's been bad all year, but it falls off a cliff when you don't have him because they just don't have a lot of guys that are will not only that can score, get to the rim and score in the mid range, but that are willing to do it. It's just, everyone's just, this team's like allergic to scoring at the rim. Even when they get to the rim, they pass out and they just are so reliant on the three. As far as Phoenix goes, good win for them. They stay hot. I think they've won like 21 of their last 25 games or something. They're one of the hottest teams in the league. I was looking at your, and if anybody, and for all you guys out there, check it out. Dan posted today his top three in every award category 3 months through the season. Coach of the year, you have Monty third, which I think that's fair. You have Quinn Snyder one, Tom Thibodeau, Knicks we'll talk about in a second, Monty Williams third. I was actually interested that Doc's not in your top three.
Yeah, I thought about tying him and Monty Williams, but that I felt like that was the coward's way to go about it. And I put a tie somewhere else on that that article. Doc Rivers has been really good. And I think I do think he's been aided by the fact that the roster makes more sense. But his decision to be like, you know what, we're not going to separate Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons super stringently. And I do know, you know, he's unlocked Tobias Harris. It's very clear that he knows how to use Tobias Harris. So with Coach of the Year, and you could say this about other awards this season, but every season, Coach of the Year is one of the awards where if you want to sell me on like a dozen candidates, I'll listen to you. You want to tell me that Greg Popovich deserves it this year because the Spurs are defending way above their talent level? Heck yeah, I'll listen to you.
That's a good point.
But look, the Suns are I get things wrong 99% of the time. I was actually right about the Suns. I said I thought they were going to be one of the biggest threats to come out of the West this year. And I really think they are. That, you know, you talked that you might pick them as one of those teams after the All-Star break, you said. I can't remember what it was.
It's interesting. Exactly. Like before the season, we did bold predictions and I said they were the second best team in the West. And then they kind of went on a little bit of a slide. And then after the break, now I said they're going to finish with, I didn't say they were going to win the West, but they could. I think they'll finish with the best record in the NBA.
And it's amazing if that's not a hot take. And the thing with this team, I like so much about them. I think their depth is kind of undersold. And if you try and go suss out trades for them, that's when you really understand it. It's like, well, who the heck are they going to move? Like they can't, like, no, he's Saric is too important. Jay Crowder is too important to what they're doing. So they defend really well. And I think that they're the teams that can defend a bunch of different ways, given how well Saric has played at the five. What I think amazes me most is it doesn't feel like they've peaked yet. Devin Booker and Chris Paul are still very clearly figuring each other out. DeAndre Ayton, who he's one of my siren songs. I really believe there's a great NBA player in there, but he is so maddeningly inconsistent. And I think that his defense, you know, teams have done a better job of kind of pulling him out even further. And so he can get burned there now too, where everyone's like, look at how switchable DeAndre Ayton is. And teams are like, well, let's put him in front of a guard 20 feet away from the basket. He's going to get torched anyway. And yet they're still a top tier defense because of how Saric is defending. And I guess the two things you could point to would be, I mean, they don't get to the foul line. There's stuff like that, but I don't know how much stock people place in this, but Chris Paul is really the only one, and Jay Crowder, who've been there, done that in the postseason. Devin Booker, Mikal Bridges, Ayton, Cam Johnson, like, that's all new to them. The other thing is, though, if DeAndre Ayton is going to be this inconsistent, you are probably going to run into problems at the five in certain matchups, because how well does Dario Saric, the five, work against, you know, a fully healthy Jazz team with Gobert, or Jokic with the Nuggets, Anthony Davis with the Lakers, because we know he'll at least be closing games at the five. So there are definitely things to worry about with this team. They are, I said this at the beginning of the season, and it clearly wasn't a hot enough take. I think they're the biggest threat to come out of the West aside from the Lakers. And I've yet to see anything to move me off that. And the Jazz are fantastic. I want to make that clear. I'm sure you've heard this, and I don't know, maybe we come to see that it doesn't matter. I still just worry, like, who is the bigger wing defender in the playoffs for them? I'm a big believer in Rudy Gobert, but you're not putting Royce O'Neal on LeBron or Anthony Davis or Kawhi or Paul George. And I know no one can stop any of those guys, but you're going to have to go through at least one of them, if not both. And those two teams have two of those guys. You need at least one of the one no-brainer body to be like, okay, you go guard, you know, Kawhi Leonard, you go guard Paul George. They don't, people will say Joe Ingles because of what he did to Paul George in that one series when they were in OKC. It's not Joe Ingles right now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I don't buy the Jazz. I never have. And I think what we've seen in the second half is that even though they're playing some good basketball, a lot of their success in the first half of the season was probably based on their health. You know, that I think they've only had three different starting lineups all year, whereas every other team, they've been remarkably healthy in a season where every other team's falling apart at different points in the year.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of their success early in the year, their record wise, not that they're not a good team, but I think it was definitely an overreaction to think that they're as good as their record indicates. They're a good team. They're probably top four in the West, but I don't even know, like, ultimately if I would trust them to beat, you know, Lakers, Suns, Clippers, even the Nuggets, the way they're starting to play. I don't know that I would trust them to beat any of those teams in a 7-game series. And a lot of it does come down to what you're saying. And that's why the Suns are much better, at least in my eyes, suited to go deeper in the playoffs, because in addition to having two of the best guards in the NBA, they also have great wing defenders in Mikal Bridges and Jay Crowder. And Chris Paul, by the way, no slouch as a defender. He can guard up because he's a good one-on-one defender too. So yeah, I think they're definitely more built to make a run in the playoffs than the Jazz. The Jazz are just, I can't buy it. And I really like Donovan Mitchell too. I don't think Donovan Mitchell is the best player on a championship team. And maybe that's just an easy, just like blanket statement to make, but it's hard for me to see a 6'3 guard who's essentially a volume scorer being a guy that leads you to a championship. It just doesn't work for me. Now the way the NBA is now, the wing player, it's such a wing dominant league. You're not going to see a team go to the finals as the league, as it's currently constructed, without pretty high level wing players. And the Jazz wing players are just okay. Like you said, I mean, Bogdanovich and Joe and Royce O'Neal they're just okay.
Yeah, I think, look, Donovan Mitchell, Rudy Gobert is the most valuable player to that team. And maybe that's problematic, maybe it's not. I think people, you know, it's become reflexive to say he can be played off the floor in the playoffs. And it was like, it happened once, and it was, they kind of figured it out by the end. I'm not trying to say it was successful in that Houston series. So I don't really worry about their offense, because I think what they've compromised with, like, defensive diversification on the wings, you now at least have enough shot creation. In addition to Donovan Mitchell, where it's like Mike Conley and Bojan Bogdanovic, and even Jordan Clarkson, he's kind of fallen off a little bit since his hot start, but you have enough shot creation to where, even if you don't think Donovan Mitchell's going to be the best player on a championship team, you have enough crunch time weapons. I think your offense ends up being fine. I just can't get around the wing stuff. And I've yet to figure out whether I'm harping too much on it, but just in a closing unit where if you have Anthony Davis closing at the five as the Lakers, or what happens, you know, the Clippers have played Marcus Morris fairly liberally at the five this year. If they close with him at the five, they just run into all sorts of problems. And even peak Joe Ingles was just not like this super athletic defender. And I think you hit it on the head, is that there are, maybe I would pick them to win a series against, I don't know that I would pick a series. They wouldn't win in my book against the Suns, the Nuggets, or either of the LA teams right now, or at least they wouldn't be a no-brainer pick for me. Yeah, they can beat the Lakers if they don't have Anthony Davis and LeBron James. Listen, that should be okay.
Here's what's wild to me. At full strength, are they a no-brainer to beat the Blazers?
I would say probably not. I would pick them to do it, but that's not something I'd be like, oh, Jazz in 4 or 5. I would think about it.
I mean, the way Damian Lillard is playing this year, and at full strength, they're a pretty good team. I mean, but yeah, I wouldn't pick it. I mean, I would probably pick the Jazz to win, but it could end up looking something like what we saw with the Jazz and the Nuggets last year, you know. But all right, two more games. By the way, we didn't get Dame time. Nets win 116-112. I guess continuing to bolster James Harden's MVP,
right?
You know, conversation.
Beats another MVP, yeah.
Because you know, no Kyrie again in this game. And then we didn't really talk. Oh, we talked Philly enough. I mean, Philly ends up beating the Warriors 108-98, but not a whole lot out of that game because no Steph Curry, other than the Warriors are just atrocious to watch without Steph Curry. And then no Joel Embiid still. So the other two games was Denver beat Orlando 110-99. And notable in that is because Jokic, again, 28, 15, and 10. You have him on your MVP list. Do you think with the injuries now, I mean, and we don't know how long Giannis is going to be out. It might only be a couple games, but like you said, maybe they start to rest him more because of it, because they're pretty locked in. Does he start to rise up in this MVP conversation just out of attrition almost because everybody else is getting hurt?
Yeah, I would say definitely. I think for a while it felt like it was him, LeBron, or Embiid. And naturally, it makes sense now. Jokic should be the unquestioned number one. I think people are just kind of starting to realize how strong of a case Giannis has. And then Dame helping the Blazers navigate the absences from CJ and Nurkic. But look, if the Nuggets are able to jump the Lakers in the standings and they finish fourth, and you want to go beyond this. Jokic might be the best offensive player in basketball this season. Just the numbers he's putting up are absurd. He's shooting like 60-something percent on twos in addition to hitting his threes. It's absolutely mind-melting, and we know the passing stuff. I think if you told me to guess who's going to win MVP right now, I would say Nikola Jokic. My pick at this moment would be Giannis, but Jokic, it feels like the stage really is set. And if you're going to tell me that Giannis misses any type of semi-significant time, and I'm of the mind in this pandemic season, we should give players a little bit of a cushion where it's like you miss 10 games, fine. I know it's a larger chunk of the season, but so much unpredictability. But if Giannis ends up missing like 5 or 7 games over the course of the season, and you have Jokic who plays in, let's say, 68 of 72 or whatever it is, he might just become the easier pick. And the only one I could really see challenging him in that instance would be, does James Harden come alive? Because let's just say Kevin Durant's injury is worse than we expected, and he barely plays again this year. I don't know that Dame... I don't know that the Blazers have the juice with Dame to really help them climb high enough in the standings for him to make it work, but he's certainly up there too.
Who would have thought, right? You could never account for this type of season, right? But who would have ever thought that being a little schlubby and a little unathletic would be so valuable in a year? Because, you know, you look at Jokic doesn't get hurt. Harden doesn't get hurt. And I've talked about this a few times. It's like, you know, maybe there's something to it. You know, you see these guys that are completely jacked. They're wound so tight. They get these soft tissue injuries. We rarely see the chubby, schlubby guys get soft tissue injuries that keep them out for a long time. Other than Luka's had this ankle thing since last year. He's on and off, and he's a little bit in on that boat too. But it's pretty interesting that the two leaders for MVP right now might be the two guys that everyone's always knocked for their physique. And I think it's pretty funny in a shortened year where – who knows? I don't know. Maybe playing every night is stressing out some of these jack dudes.
Yeah. And it was also, I mean, this isn't really along the same lines. I've always wondered if it's guys who control the pace more than anyone else of a game, where LeBron is that super athletic type, but he's decided at the rate play is going to unfold. And basically every single game he's ever played in the NBA, at least post his first go around in Cleveland. And to have that type of control over a game sort of allows you to, if you're going to slow it down and grind it out in the half court, it would help, where I feel like KD and even Kyrie, like they have more variant speeds. So maybe I have no science to back this up, but that was sort of, I didn't really give the in shape or the, I don't want to say the body type. I didn't give that as much consideration. Schlubby.
Yeah, no, I've thought about that even since I was in the league, because when I was working in the league, because we had a guy that I'm sure you're well aware of named Boris Diaw. Now, Boris was fat. I mean, it is just called what it is. Boris was fat, especially after the lockout year. But Boris never really missed games unless he chose to miss games. He was never hurt because he played at a pace. He played at his pace. He played his game. And I just think he never played athletic enough because of the shape he was in to have like these weird injuries. It was just, I think it's a combination of the body type and having to, because of the body type, having to play at a certain pace and learning to play your own pace. LeBron's obviously an anomaly because he plays at the pace and he's a freak. But these other guys, just like, there's not, I don't know. It's always interested me since I was in the league. But yeah, Boris was like admittedly just out of shape. Like, he just, you know, but he was an interesting one. The other thing that I'll point out for the Nuggets real quick is the quiet emergence of Michael Porter Jr. that we've seen over the last, I don't know how many games, but definitely since the break, he's starting, I think, to develop into a guy that if he becomes this type of scorer that we know he can be, they will be a tough out for any team in the playoffs. That big three, Michael Porter Jr. in particular, he's so important at his development as the wing scorer for that team, especially the way Jamal Murray is up and down. The way he's playing right now, he's starting to trend towards potentially making this team a super dangerous team come playoff time.
Yeah, I've yet to dig deeper into it. It seems like he really started to turn when he was put in the starting lineup as the four next to Jokic. What I've noticed too is I do think Michael Porter Jr. has gotten better as a help defender since that's happened. But when you look at the lineup data with him at the four and Jokic at the five and Jamal Murray on the court, those lineups are just suspiciously stingy. I don't know why they're so good defensively. I haven't dug deeper into it. I don't know that I've watched closely enough. Michael Porter Jr.'s improved health defense would not be the primary reason I would say those numbers are up there. That would be just my concern with this team is you lost Torrey Craig, you lost Jeremy Grant. I think that's why they're so big into the Aaron Gordon, Harrison Barnes sweepstakes. You might not even have those guys playing their best position all the time, which is the four, but Gordon, especially, he and Michael Porter Jr. could be interchangeable. Essentially, it feels like they need to make that move to be really scary. But if you're going to have three scorers of that level on the same team, this is not, I'm not going to compare them to what's going on in Brooklyn, but the recipe of just having three superstar scorers who can get you a shot at any level, at any point in the shot clock, at any time in the game, it means a whole lot. And we've seen Jamal Murray this isn't just him going off in the bubble during the playoffs. He's gone off in the playoffs before. He's also cost in playoff games. That seems like it's the trade-off. But to have that guy who you can still turn to in crunch time or who's going to give you the occasional 40-point playoff game and to have maybe the MVP in Jokic, but then also Michael Porter Jr. on top of that, who is, you know, he might be the least guardable of the three just because of the jumpers that he's going to take over the top of people. So yeah, people were worried about them, myself included, towards earlier in the season, but the Michael Porter Jr. stuff seems to be clicking. I'm just curious to see what happens to them defensively. And like I said, I don't understand. Maybe a Nuggets person can point that out who's smarter than I am. What is going on defensively in those lineups that they've been so successful?
Yeah, on the unguardable thing, I don't think, could you name 10 guys in the NBA right now that are that size that can score the way Michael Porter Jr. can? I don't think you can. I mean, he's 6'10", so probably not. But even just from a wing perspective, outside of like KD, LeBron, Tatum, Paul George, Kawhi, like after that, you're starting to just like throw guys in there because just from a upside and talent standpoint at that size, there's not a lot of guys that can do it.
Right. And he's their third option, which is why it's so wild.
Yeah. It's crazy. All right. Last game before we just talk real quickly about a few of the, even though we've hit most of the big trade deadline names, the Knicks win 131-113 over the Wizards. Julius Randle, 7 of 10 from three. 37 points in 37 minutes. You had him second right now for most improved player. Is there a world after what Jeremy Grant basically did in the first half where you see Julius Randle playing his way into most improved player? Because I've talked about that a few times this year where because of not just what he's doing statistically and being an all-star, but the implication that he's rejuvenated one of the most storied franchises almost – I don't want to say single-handedly, but take him off this team this year. They're not good. So, so it's almost single him and Thibodeau, obviously, but you know, this is, I actually before last season said watch out for Julius Randle in New York. He's too talented not to put up crazy numbers and at least be near all-star level. It took a year, but now he's doing it. But he's also shooting plus 40% from three, and he shot 7 for 10 tonight. I think he could potentially catch Jeremy Grant because he seems to have regressed a little bit in the second half.
Yeah, the Jeremy Grant's efficiency is way down. The thing I've struggled with is that, you know, because the criteria for most improved is so nebulous, it does feel like we're on the lookout for the next potential superstar, which you would give to, you know, Julius Randle isn't that much younger, but he's more, has a better chance at superstardom than Jeremy Grant. And then Shai Gilgeous-Alexander might fit this mold too, a little bit more. It's just Jeremy Grant is playing so differently in such a higher volume role, just exponentially. The fact that he hasn't fallen off a cliff is amazing to me. And I might always favor that. And then Julius Randle is doing a lot of the stuff that he always did. It's just the ball is in his hands more. And so it's the matter of opportunity and volume, but I don't know how big of a contrast in play style to previous years it is. I think the two big differences for him are the 3-point shooting where, you know, some of those have been unassisted too. And like he's hitting those looks. They don't actually look pretty just from someone who's watched a lot of him. They're going in. And his defense has been a lot better this year. I never envisioned a world where I would say, you know, playing him at the five is an okay idea. There've been games this season. And I think there was one game, it was the Nets game, their most recent game against the Nets, where they closed him at the five and he just galvanized them at both ends in that stretch. And so that's absolutely huge. And so if Jeremy Grant sort of continues, you know, going down like this, and it could happen. The Pistons are not good. He doesn't have help. Like Sadiq Bey is cool, and having Killian Hayes healthy will be fun, but they just don't have a lot of other creators on that team. There's definitely a world in which Julius Randle can win it. And if he, I don't even look at the team success so much just because I don't know what that has to do. You know, how do you measure player improvement? Like Jeremy Grant shouldn't be less improved because the Pistons suck. They're built to suck. At the same time, the fact that he's doing this for a team that was expected to be just terrible, sort of on the same level as the Pistons and might take them to the playoffs. If Julius Randle's shooting 40%+ from three, averaging LeBron like points and assists, he might have a real, I won't even say might, he probably will end up winning the award.
And I think also, I don't know about you and I don't know about the voters, how they reacted, but I think we, like on this show, we reacted this way and a lot of people reacted this way. I think it's also relative to the contract that he got. When people saw the number and the money that Detroit paid him to essentially be their best player, everyone was like, Jeremy Grant can't be that guy. And he, now they're not good, but he's showing that he at least can keep up somewhat what no one really, I didn't expect him to be this type of offensive player. And I thought it was going to crush Denver defensively to lose him, but I never thought he was this guy. So I think that'll tie into it a lot too, is that relative to what people expected. I think a lot of people saw the contract he got and expected it to be a huge disappointment.
Oh, I was among them. And I thought, you know, I love when players bet on themselves. I thought it was a dumb move. As you had the same amount of money to go play in a role that you knew you were good at and on a better team, he bet on himself and it worked. And it's sort of like, you know, the cases are what constitutes most improved more? Is it Jeremy Grant, who has now discovered that his peak is exponentially higher than we could have thought? Or is it Julius Randle, who now we know that his peak can help a really good team, or I don't want to say really good, a good team more than we ever thought. And so it's an interesting sort of push and pull there. I do think just the way that Jeremy Grant has, the efficiency has at least regressed. Someone like me might look into it and be like, hey, he's run twice as many pick and rolls, or he's run more pick and rolls this season than he has his entire career combined before now. And so I'll look stuff like that and be like, you know, that might matter a little bit more to me, but I can't fault anyone who would have Julius Randle number one right now. And again, just the, you want to look at it, he's even a better passer. Like he had that Russell Westbrook or Giannis pre this season type feel where he was just passing because defenses like collapsed and it was almost a last resort. He's passing guys open now and with feel. And that probably matters too. I might even be talking myself into Julius Randle as we speak.
I mean, it's remarkable what he's doing. And when you watch that team, they have some young guys with upside, but that team's rough. I mean, it's rough outside of Julius. I mean, they have some guys, but they're playing some guys too, that you're like, couldn't make it anywhere else. All right, let's talk real quickly about, we hit a few of the bigger names from the deadline. Obviously, we don't really need to get into Lowry because we talked about what, you know, Heat, Sixers, which is really the only teams it looks like he might go to if he gets traded. However, I last night was talking to my, I did a solo episode last night and I was talking to myself about this. And I actually said this before the Siakam news came out today, that I said yesterday after that loss to the Rockets, that this, that the buzz has been about where's Lowry going to go and where's Norm Powell going to go. But I feel like there should be more talk about where's everyone on this team going to go. I think when you look at the roster construction and the money that they gave to these guys and what we're seeing out of this team, I don't think if I'm Masai, anything is off the table. I'm listening to calls on every player. And then you get this report today that Siakam's fined $50,000 for whatever he said to Nick Nurse, which is very interesting to me because did he say it in front of Masai? Did Nick Nurse go to Masai and say, hey, he said this to me? Like, how did they find out that he said it and he got fined? Like, coaches can't find players like that. That has to come. You have to go to the front office fine. You know, like, there's a structure to the fine thing. Mm-hmm. So how do they know that he said these things to Nick Nurse? That's a weird situation in and of itself. But, you know, they paid all this money to Fred VanVleet and Siakam and even OG Anunoby. This team is very disappointing, I think, to a lot of people, but also I think this is not super surprising. I don't think any of these guys are necessarily worth the money they got for the roles that this team's expecting them to play. And I said after last night's game, I know they've had a rough go because of the COVID stuff, but last night against the Rockets, they were fully healthy other than OG Anunoby, and they got beat by 20 to a team that had just lost 20 games in a row. This team, even if they get fully healthy, I don't know that this team's doing anything with the way they're built. I would be listening to any offers, and I wouldn't be shocked if a big move comes out of Toronto that during this trade deadline. The question just becomes, would any team want to take on those deals at this point?
So I feel like I both agree and disagree. I agree that they should probably be listening to any offer because I don't know where I think you're accurate on Pascal Siakam is they paid him and they treated him like they could develop him into the best player on a championship team. I think it's now been proven that he can't be that. I'm still a firm believer though, that if this team was at full strength, they can be a lot better. You did mention the COVID stuff, just knowing how long it's taken some guys to come back from COVID, the fact that they were disrupted by injuries and then COVID midseason, and they're also playing in Tampa. So they're just playing 100% of the time away from the road. I weight that really heavily. I also, you know, I really like OG Anunoby. Fred VanVleet, I think, is at least living up to his contract. I don't think they would have problems getting value for any of those guys. And OG Anunoby's weird because the extension and the poison pill, but I don't think any of them have played their way into being untouchable. And if you look, they are in this weird spot. We're talking about a Lowry trade, but the reason you move Lowry, unless he asks, and maybe even if he does ask, is because you want to do something more long-term. And you have these players where, aside from OG Anunoby, they're all at these weird in-between ages when you look at VanVleet and Pascal Siakam. Boucher. So if you are trying to think about the bigger picture, yeah, Chris Boucher, another one of my siren songs. I love that guy. Yeah.
He's like 27 though, right?
He's 27. Old? Siakam's like 26, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe he's 25. VanVleet is around that same age too. So yeah, you should absolutely listen to offers. I'd be curious to see. To me, it would start with Siakam because I think the idea of him is probably the hardest player to replace just because of what he can give you defensively, and you still go to him as a ball handler. Maybe it's VanVleet, but which team? You know, I haven't even thought about the Pascal Siakam trade market is the problem. I don't know which team would get, you know, does a team like the Knicks decide, like, can you get a rebuilding team or a team that isn't really good now that has a ton of assets to kind of go semi all in? It would be Thunder. like a Knicks stage team, a Chicago Bulls stage team, the Thunder. Do you get one of them to give you, you know, close to a treasure trove? I don't know if Siakam's at that level. If I were running a team, I would 100% do it. If I were Phoenix, I'm putting Cam Johnson, DeAndre Ayton, and picks on the table to see if I can get DeAndre Pascal Siakam in Phoenix. I'm a still big believer in Pascal Siakam. And I actually think if you get the Raptors in the playoffs and they're fully healthy, if they can get into that point, I think they're still a team that can win a playoff series, which is why I kind of don't want to see them trade Kyle Lowry, just because I feel like there's an unplumbed peak to this team. But I also just get what you're saying, because if a Kyle Lowry trade becomes the reality, you do have to, I've seen some people sort of speculate that, well, maybe they're not that much worse without Kyle Lowry. My issue there is that, one, it's just like, yes, they are. They're worse without Kyle Lowry. He's that team's identity too. It feels like they adopt his play style when he's on the court. And so I have a tough time envisioning them at least having a clear road to getting really good if they're moving off Lowry. And then also, if you move off Lowry, you're kind of just you're not necessarily accelerating your rebuild so much as you're steering harder into the no man's land of the NBA, where teams that can't win a title, but they don't suck.
Yeah. Yeah. But aren't they kind of there now?
They are. I just feel like they're deeper, where if they keep Lowry and they're healthy, you can talk me into them making real noise in the East. If you trade Lowry, if you trade Norman Powell, they feel like they'll be like a first round stepping stone.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not convinced that they're not, but I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. We talked about Oladipo briefly. You know, he's going to be a free agent. He doesn't want to be in Houston. And I think it sounds like Houston's going to trade him. Like, that's what people are saying, is that they plan to trade him before the deadline. But they're going to have to come off of whatever value they think he has, because he still doesn't look great and he's a free agent. I just don't know where he ends up. Like, he's a guy who I could see ending up with the Knicks, but what do the Knicks have to give Houston at this point? You know, it's like,
they have stuff to give. Why would you give up anything for Victor Oladipo?
Exactly. And
I think in the Charania report, I saw a report where it was like, you see what comes from the agent, where it's like giving a recap of the team where it says Victor Oladipo has played well since coming over from Indy. And it's like, is there a different Victor Oladipo that I've seen?
Yeah, who are we watching?
And just on top of that, he had a right quad injury that no one's talking about since he's been in Houston. Like, that was the quad that he ruptured the tendon in that cost him, essentially, was it a year of basketball that really ripped him from his all-star form? So you have to move him. And now the choice because they punted on Caris LeVert and a second round pick for Oladipo. That was the choice they made. You're not getting that even close to that value now. And I know people I've talked to have told me, well, they valued the cap space more. And I sort of alluded to this before. Worry about getting cap space when you need cap space. And this summer, I would be strongly of the belief that you can just trade Caris LeVert into some team's cap space while still getting value back. You're not going to get anything like that along the lines for Victor Oladipo, who's a soon-to-be free agent anyway. But I think the Knicks and Miami are the teams that keep being regurgitated. What are you giving up, like, Kevin Knox and a Dallas pick for Victor Oladipo if you're the Knicks? That almost feels like too much for them.
Yeah, I think it does seem like Miami, at least, if you want, you could give up a pick, which they don't have many to give up, and like a Kendrick Nunn, maybe, like, that would be like the ideal thing for a Heat team. If you're playing, but then you also have to decide, do you want to extend them? But I guess you have the rest of the season to figure that out. I don't know. Yeah, I'd stay away from it, and I would just wait to see if you can get him in free agency. Aaron Gordon, we mentioned, but I guess there's a bunch of teams interested. Makes sense. High upside. You mentioned the Nuggets, which would be interesting. I think the other team that's been linked to him is the Celtics. I think he would be huge for them. They have no depth. The offer that I saw, or the report that I saw, again, I don't know how real these are or whatever, but it was Gordon and Fournier for Marcus Smart, and then whatever makes the deals work, which would be interesting to me. I mean, I think it would make the Celtics deeper. I do think they would definitely miss Marcus Smart. He is their defensive leader and sort of like the heartbeat type player for that team. But their front court's pretty rough. So Aaron Gordon would be an upgrade for them. Is there a team that you think makes the most sense for Gordon? They say Celtics, Rockets, Wolves, Nuggets, Blazers are all teams that have at least inquired.
I would love to see him next to Carl Anthony Towns, but the Wolves have no business trading what it would take to get Aaron Gordon. I like the Celtics too, because they have assets, but you have to weigh it, like, with the Harrison Barnes stuff as an example. I don't know that he would be a part of their closing lineup, because you have Kemba, Smart, Brown, and Tatum. Are you playing Barnes at the five? I don't know that that works. Gordon, I think it works better. So you can, he's going to be part of your closing lineup. I don't love the idea of giving up Smart, but then I guess if you look at the Celtics, you have Tatum and Brown and then Gordon coming in, you're probably still a pretty good defensive team without Smart. I'm with you. He's the lifeblood of that team. Maybe getting Fournier as well, and if you're getting off Tristan Thompson's money for next season too, softens that burden. I want to see Gordon in Boston is the most intriguing fit to me. I don't know that I would do it if it's costing you, or I wouldn't do it if it's costing me Marcus Smart if I were the Celtics. And I really, Portland would be out of excuses for why their defense is so bad if they have Rocco, Derek Jones, and Aaron Gordon on the team. But he feels like he makes so much sense there with the way that he's been shooting the three ball. And it feels like all these guys go to Portland for the most part and start shooting better from three.
Yeah.
Even Derek Jones Jr. this season, So I would love to see him there. And I've thought about like, what would be a team that hasn't been mentioned that would just make or be an interesting Aaron Gordon fit. And I've stumbled into points where like, I would love to see the Knicks maybe make a dark horse run at him. Not their defense is already good enough, but I feel like they sort of lack dynamic players where it's, you know, if Mitchell Robinson right. or Julius Randle, they're these one position players, Gordon's like a three position player. Mm-hmm. And so that would be the team like, hey, it's sort of, you're not going all in, but you're buying someone who fits a more gradual timeline. He's, you know, I'm surprised he hasn't been traded before every season. I feel like since he signed this contract that he's on, he's been in the rumor mill. Whichever team gets him, I think is probably going to be the winner at the deadline to me, unless one, they overpay obviously, or if there's like a player that we don't see coming that gets moved.
Yeah, I agree. I think his upside's high. The Knicks one, I haven't really thought about, but that is him and Julius Randle next to each other would be fun. That would be a really interesting front court. The two other guys that I don't think will get moved that I saw today that I guess apparently their teams are listening on offers for them is one I don't understand. One, I guess I understand Malcolm Brogdon, which I don't really get because I love Malcolm Brogdon. I thought it was such a massive mistake for the Bucks to let him go when they did. And I think he's really good I think he's the ideal point guard in today's NBA. And then Lauri Markkanen, who I guess I can kind of see it if they don't plan on, if he's not part of their future and they don't want to pay him what he wants, I could see it. Although he is high upside talented guy. Could you see either? Do you think either of them, have you heard anything? Do you think either of them potentially on the move?
I'd be shocked if anything happens with Brogdon. And I saw the Yahoo Sports report that they might entertain offers on Sabonis or teams are looking for that. They've yet to see their best 5-man unit play together this mm-hmm. year, which is, you know, Warren, Sabonis, Turner, Brogdon, and LeVert. They're the four guys who are healthy have played sub 200 possessions together. I was looking this up before. I understand they're probably concerned about paying the tax because McConnell and McDermott are up after this year. And then you have TJ Warren's next deal in 2022. If you're worried about paying the tax because of those guys, you move TJ McConnell or Doug McDermott. You don't move Malcolm Brogdon. Yeah. I would be floored if they did anything. And if they do anything surprising, it's probably a Turner trade, right? It's not Sabonis or Brogdon of all players. The Bulls need to move Lauri Markkanen. He plays your most important long-term players aside from Levine, Patrick Williams' best position probably. And he just hasn't shown like this deep offensive skill set. He can hit threes, but like, he's not doing a ton of stuff off the dribble. He's not getting the foul line a ton. I don't know what he does for you. And maybe he costs little enough where you're fine keeping him around. But if you don't want to pay him, and again, you have Patrick Williams and all the reports say that they don't want to move Thaddeus Young either. And so it's like, all right, if you want to keep Thaddeus Young and you have Patrick Williams, it's time to move Lauri Markkanen. And if you're, they might be out on Wendell Carter Jr. too. Like that would be the actual, when people have asked me surprise names that could be moved, Wendell Carter Jr. is the guy I keep coming back to because it feels like the Bulls might just be, I won't even say a little, like a really low on him long-term.
It's weird too, because I feel like they're a little bit ahead of where I expected them to be this year, but at the same time, they seem willing to move a lot of their young guys, which is, it's like, although obviously not Zach and not, I don't know how they feel about Kobe White. And I think Patrick Williams has been a pleasant surprise to a lot of people. Not me. I went to Florida State. I watched the kid.
He was, I loved him coming in. I was still, and granted, I was deathly ill during the NBA draft this year. I called out sick from work that day and I have to be dying for that to happen on draft day. Yeah. I woke up and saw that he was picked at number 4. And I was like, what?
Yeah. I mean, I was shocked about that. I was high on him, but I was definitely, I was like, I think everyone was like, what? Yeah. Huh? Patrick Williams.
I mean, kudos to Chicago, but that was like, you talk about, I know the draft was unpredictable after number 3, but you talk about taking a swing. They took a swing.
And then Okoro. I thought Okoro was the same thing. I didn't expect Okoro to go as high as he went too. That was back-to-back picks, right?
Yeah, I guess I saw mocks with Okoro going a little bit high. Like I had seen mocks where Patrick Williams was going at the end of the first round. And I know he had moved up, but I was like, 4?
Yeah, and I watched a ton of Florida. I haven't watched much college basketball this year, but I watched a ton of Florida State last year. I was higher on Devin Vassell. I really was, just because from a skill set standpoint, like his skills translated. Obviously, Patrick Williams was the higher level athlete, bigger, could probably play multiple positions, but Vassell, watching him in college, I was like, damn, this kid's going to come in the league and be a shooter and a scorer. Like he gave me like a little bit of a Chris Middleton vibe. I mean, he's in his first year and he's not playing a ton in San Antonio, but
he looks good though. Like he's not doing as much stuff on the ball as you'd like to see him do, but you know, he and Tyrese Halliburton are the two what ifs. If you're definitely the Knicks after taking Toppin, but think about, we were just talking about the Suns. Had the Suns gone with Tyrese Halliburton over Jalen Smith, I think Devin Vassell was off the board by the time they were up, right? But like those were the two players I had circled for them. I was like, this team is going to, would be absolutely killer if they had, you know, one of those two guys on. But yeah, this draft class has surprised me with how deep it appears to be during their rookie seasons.
Draft, we talked about it the other day. Being a draft analyst is like, it's the best, because it's like, you can have a
weatherman of basketball coverage.
Yeah, it's right? Unbelievable, because it's like last year, it's like, oh, this draft has no stars, maybe LaMelo, but really there's Anthony Edwards. Is he even a star? And now it's looking like this draft looks really good. And then there's guys talking about how the top five picks in next year's draft are all franchise players. And it's like one of the deepest draft top fives we've seen. And with Cade Cunningham and Mobley and Kuminga and all these guys, it's like, really, they're all going to be franchise players? I don't know, man. It seems unlikely. It doesn't shake out that way. But hey, I mean, it just seems like it's like that and being a fantasy analyst. It's like, you know, like,
oh man,
you can't be wrong. I mean, you can be wrong, but then you're just updating it so often that the next day you're right.
Yeah, there's a lot of hedging involved in that, but I have to look, I can't, just the scale at which I'm like, I cover the league, I just can't watch college basketball. I crash course before the draft. And so I'm just like, yeah, I'm going to assume that I've seen highlights of Cade Cunningham. I'm just going to assume that he's going to be amazing because that's what everyone's saying. Until I do my own research around like draft time, I'm just going to assume that Cade Cunningham is the next great thing.
I'm going to be so beyond. Up until this year, I was either working in the league or I was working at CBS Sports where I was producing. So I had to watch like tape to know like what highlights and which guys. I've watched the two Florida State tournament games are the first college basketball games I've watched all year. And they'll probably,
I don't know how you watch college basketball, period.
I hate it. We've talked about it on this show plenty. I like the other night, the play-in games round, right? The first night of the NCAA tournament was the same night that Anthony Edwards went for 42. There was only six games that night. There was 8 35 plus point games in the NBA, 3 40 point games. Anthony Edwards became the third youngest player ever to score 42. And all anyone was talking about how two teams I've never heard of finished 54 or 53. And I'm like, how can you be watching that when this is happening in the NBA? It's mind blowing to me. College basketball stinks. It's crazy. Cause when I was at Florida State, there was a part of me that was like, I think I could stay and coach in college basketball. Then I got to my first year working in the league. I'm like, never again. Yes. College basketball.
So. I can't watch it. Kudos to people who cover the draft full time. And I understand why the level of play is so much slower. The talent's diluted. You're dealing with, they don't have the same like time to invest in development or time with their team they do at the NBA level. It's just when you go from, I think I feel it most because you've gone from watching how many NBA games and then you go to watch a college basketball game. It's so much different.
Yeah. I mean, I could do a whole breakdown. I could do a dissertation on my problems with college basketball. But look, to me, and I don't know enough about college football, although I watch it, or college baseball or anything like that. But to me, it's the only amateur, and I say that with quotes, right? Amateur sport that is supposed to be a funnel system to a pro sport. It's a fundamentally different game. You're not watching the same game when you're watching college basketball in the NBA. And part of that is the rules are just so different. Everything's different.
35 second shot clock.
Different shot clock, shorter 3-point line, two 20 minute halves instead of four quarters, TV timeouts every 4 minutes. So the pace of the game gets drastically slowed down. Zone defense. So teams can just camp out and they don't really have to learn how to play defense. It's a different game. You're fundamentally watching a different game. And that also is, I think what doesn't get talked about when you're talking about draft development is that teams, everyone's like, oh, people don't want old players. No, it's not that they don't want old players. It's that when you've played 4 years in a college system, you have learned how to play the wrong type of basketball. Like 22 is not that old, but when you're 22 and you've played 4 years at Florida State, no offense to my guys, but like, you've played 4 years in a college system and now you have to be totally broken down and retaught basketball. Whereas when you're 19 and you've been in college for 6 months, it's more pliable because they haven't been ingrained with this is how we win at the college level.
Yeah, for sure. I couldn't agree more with you.
Yeah. We got on. That's a great tangent. I love it. To be continued, because I want to have you back, but I appreciate you coming on. This been a great episode. Hardwood Knox. I'm not going to say hard court, not hardwood court. I'm good. Hardwood Knox. What's your Twitter handle for people to go follow? I think
at least you didn't stop at hardwood and you put the Knox in there. That's where people might've gotten confused.
Yeah. Tell the people your Twitter handle so they can go ahead and follow you.
It's my name at Dan FAVALE.
And go check out his article, top three at each award, 3 months through the season. Dan, really appreciate it. Hope we have you back on again soon. And yeah, appreciate you having you on.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
Yep. All right, we'll see you guys tomorrow. Tomorrow, actually, by the way, Ty Windish going to come on, talk about Bucks, Celtics, and some more free agency talk. So looking forward to that one. We'll see you guys tomorrow. Later.